Welcome to episode 10 of the Patterson Podcast. This is your host, David Mitchell. We're here to share tips and tools from the Patterson process and to hear the stories of people like you using the process to do incredible things. Our guest today is Pete Richardson, a partner and lead trainer at the Patterson Center. Pete has been facilitating StratOps and life plans over the last 20 years. He's guided 900 people through the life plan process and guided hundreds of teams through StratOp. If you missed the previous episode with Pete, take a moment to go back and listen to that too. In today's episode, we're talking about the journey of mastery. I think it can be easy for us to forget the journey that a master at anything has really been on. You see their mastery, and you can easily forget the years of struggle, the failing forward, and the breakthroughs that have come. Many of us today may be asking, do I have what it takes to master my craft? For some of you, that may be mastering facilitation. For others, it may be mastering leadership, or whatever it is that you're applying your heart and your mind to today. So today, then, we're going to talk about the struggles, the joys, the failing forward, and the breakthrough that come on the journey towards mastery. Pete, how do you think about the subject of mastery?
I think mastery is a concept that is more difficult in the times we live in to embody and embrace. And the reason why is, I think by definition, what is a master? A master, in my thinking, is someone who has over time, sometimes a lot of time, has reached this state of unconscious competency. And they've done the right things the right way for a long time. And now they can almost creatively, unconsciously enter that space. And they're not even thinking about it, but they're adding another whole level of artistry and applied discipline to years of practice and hard work. So, for example, there's many examples, but in athletics, you know, those who make it to the top professionally in their sport, they have the talent. They have a base of talent, but talent that's not cultivated stagnates. So they've cultivated it for years and rhythmically through practice and discipline and muscle memory and mental stamina, they've reached this place of unconscious competency. I recently watched the movie SOMM, S-O-M-M. It's about the journey to become a master sommelier. And Janet, my wife, we love Italy for a lot of reasons, but we love it for the Italian's passion for food and wine, and how, you know, the food growing out of the earth and the wine growing out of the earth, and how it's over time paired together in ways that makes the sensory expressions come to life in a meal. But master sommeliers, if you haven't watched this movie SOMM, you got to watch it. It's a docudrama. Of four guys who are on this journey to become master sommeliers. People say the master sommelier test is the hardest test that no one knows about, more difficult than law or medical professions. The reason why is, well, there's only 190 master sommeliers in the world. Only 190. And, you know, there's a lot of like intro level sommeliers and certified level sommeliers and even advanced level sommeliers. But to become a master sommelier, you have to be unconsciously competent in knowledge, sensory experience, and how you relate to people. And so these four characters in this movie spend like a whole year of their life to prepare for this test that most likely they're not going to pass. And they have to know everything about every wine ever grown in the world over time, over probably the last 50 years. And the real master sommeliers can smell and taste a random wine, just wine in a glass. They don't know what bottle it's been poured from. They can smell it and taste it. And they can, through a process, determine and discern what year it was vintaged, where it was planted, what grape it is, what the acidity is, and the really good ones can actually name the wine in the label. It's unbelievable, just by tasting it. So to pass the test, there's six glasses of wine, and you have to, I think, score 75% or greater to become a master sommelier. In addition, you have to be able to serve a table with great knowledge and fluidity, and have knowledge about all of this and more, like cigars and other liqueurs and things. So it's a fascinating story about the journey to mastery. And so you could apply that to anything.
And I love that, the blend there of, it's not simply in the documentary Somme about, hey, I can tell you what this wine is, but it's, can I do it with grace? And as you say, can I do it fluidly so that the client, the customer feels cared for and thought about? And I think it's true also in the art of facilitating work that you do. So what it means to be a master facilitator in Life Plan and StratOp 2 is not simply about knowing all of the tools, but it's about, how do I connect with the people in front of me? How do I guide them well?
Right. And that's this art. We call it the Socratic methodology. It goes back to Socrates and many other great leaders. Jesus was a great question asker. But in our line of work of facilitating Life Plans and StratOps, it's about mastery includes getting beyond the nature of the process or the construction of tools and the mechanics of leading a room in conversation, and where you can enter this space where you're actually a part of the conversation and you're not even thinking about the logistics of facilitating or what's next. You're fully immersed in someone's world, whether it's their life or their organization. And you're able to enter that and, through great curiosity, ask questions that excavate truth, not bringing answers, but guiding the conversation in a way that is fluid. And where, sort of like in a great football game, NFL football game, if the referees and umpires do their line ups and that, they do a great job, you don't even know they're there. But it's when they don't do a good job, everyone's yelling at them. So, you know, as a facilitator, if you're doing a good job, it's like people don't even know you're there. You're a part of the group, yes, but you're helping the group elevate its collective intelligence and insight and awareness. And you're unconsciously helping them excavate their truth and making it visible so they can make decisions on how they want to respond to it.
That's so good. You've written before then about the journey of mastery, and it's not this linear journey kind of up and to the right where each day, each week, we're making linear progress and just inevitably going to hit mastery. It's much more, as you've written about, ups and downs and failing forward and sometimes falling backwards and those things. Share with us today a couple of the key moments or learnings in your own journey towards mastery as a facilitator.
I remember way back in the early 90s as a young life plan facilitator. And I think I had done a handful, facilitated a handful of life plans, maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, somewhere in that range. And I was discouraged. I felt like the cynic in me was dominating the conversation. And it was like, who do you think you are, you know, trying to help people figure out their life purpose? This is a rich American privilege thing. And you know, you're messing people's lives up. Who do you think you are? Sort of, I was in that space mentally and emotionally. And well, I had to do my own soul searching and really reflect deeply and decide whether I was really in or not. You know, and so I think throughout my journey as a life plan facilitator and StratOp facilitator, I've hit sort of my speed bumps. And it's tested my resolve, my commitment, my will, and whether I wanted to go to the next level, whatever, not even knowing what that next level was, just knowing there was more out there that I still, that I didn't know. And I'm still there. I still, you know, I want to read more. I want to learn more. I want to create more. I don't want stagnancy and boredom scare me. And when I've hit those speed bumps, it's where great self-doubt, insecurity sets in. And it always tests my resolve, my level of passion and desire of whether I want to go into undiscovered territory for me to see if there's more to learn and apply that would help other people.
Pete, you have spent a lot of time at the feet of Tom Patterson. How did that time contribute to your thinking on mastery? Was it intimidating to be with him? Was it encouraging? And what kind of things did you glean from him that helped you in this journey?
I think early on, there was a lot of intimidation. It was like, this guy is, you know, almost divine in nature. And who am I to ask him a question even, you know? So there was some of that. But as I got to know him, and really as he invited me into his life more, in around the turn of the century, he invited me to partner with him and help train and certify other people. So I got to spend, you know, 6 to 7 weeks a year with Tom, and that, and plus other days where we were creating concepts and constructs. So he became more approachable, I guess. And it was more me. He was always approachable. But he invited me into the conversation more to use my gifts he wanted to know what I thought. And so that was really important. But I learned with Tom in those years of really pursuing him as a mentor, the value of going to him with thoughtful questions. So I always, whether I flew to see him in Arizona or Oregon or California or in Colorado when we moved him here, I always made sure I had some questions well formulated because I was on a treasure hunt for gold. Gold in his brain, gold in his heart, gold in his archives of life work. And I think great questions unlock that and help you excavate that gold. And so I was always trying to get a new nugget. I remember going to him once in Stratop and saying, Tom, I understand the concept of the cost of quality, but how do you operationalize that? How do you guide a team to understand that concept and put systems and processes to it? And, you know, he wheeled me back in his wheelchair to his filing cabinet and took out these charts and work from clients way back in the 70s and 80s. And we began to talk about what he did. And I was able to ask him, why'd you do this? How'd you do this? So it unlocked a whole vein of gold for me on just that one concept. I think that's important when you pursue a mentor. You must pursue them with great questions.
And that's a great example there too of what you've written about, that masters pass on their craft to others. What does that look like for you in this season? How do you think about passing on your craft to others? And where has that sort of brought you joy? And what does that look like for you?
Well, I'm still trying to figure that out. It's a part of the season of life I'm in that is new to me. I remember visiting Monet's estate outside of Paris in Giverny, France. And Monet mastered the lily pad. And so he had created a lily pond outside of his estate. And he would invite young artists and they would come and live with him for sometimes years. And he would engage them on painting lily pads on his pond and passed on the art of the impressionist through this venue. I think what it means for me and with that concept is, you know, I find a lot of the younger generations want things quick. They want things fast. They want to be a master now. And so I'm wrestling with, what does that mean on how you engage, how you help people develop? I don't think it's mere cognitive. I think there's got to be an invitation into watching and doing and reflecting and debriefing. And so I'm experimenting with different people right now, different younger people, letting them shadow me, letting them, giving them access to my thinking. And I don't think there's it's a formulaic cookbook process to pass on a craft. I think it's very life on life. And I'm trying to figure out what that means for me.
One of the things you spoke about before as well in your early days as a facilitator, and I think this is true for leaders and others listening too in the early days of this journey, is that one of the things that can keep us from mastery is this nemesis that you've written about called fear. And you've written before about how you kind of busted through that, began to in your own life. But when somebody comes to you and they're really, that nemesis is keeping them from moving forward, how do you coach them or guide them to bust through fear?
I think you're right. I think fear is a nemesis. I think fear, I used to think I could conquer fear. There would be a day where fear was no longer on my mental, emotional landscape. And realized pretty quickly, like, yeah, fear's a crafty villain in my story. It has a lot of faces and it morphs and it has a lot of voices. So just first of all, accepting that fear is a part of my own story. And then seeing this villain and nemesis of fear surface in hundreds of other people's story. And I'm like, wow, this is a human condition. And so I don't think, just like raising teenagers, I think if you tell a teenager what they should do, most likely they're going to resist it. But if somehow you can guide them to discover it and feel like they discovered it, they'll own it, most likely. I think that's why I love the Socratic methodology and Life Plan and Stratop is I don't have to tell anyone about fear. I can guide people through the processes we have at Patterson Center to see it for themselves and to name it. I think to put a name to fear is really important. I used to be a prisoner of the fear of what other people thought about me. And, you know, I was kind of born with this bent on thinking I could be perfect. I remember as a little kid waking up almost every day thinking today's going to be the perfect day and going to bed that night going, oh, it wasn't. Tomorrow's maybe tomorrow. And my parents didn't raise me that way. My dad used to tell me, hey, go get an F today at school, you know, just to lighten me up a little bit, you know, and because I was so intense and driven and cared so deeply about what my teachers and coaches and later professors thought about me. And if I disappointed him, it was devastating. So, yeah, I had another mentor back in the 90s, Bill McCartney, Coach Bill McCartney, and he called me out on my fear of men, my fear of other people, and hit it head on. And it turned out to be a turning point for me. And over years and really digging into it, you know, I don't feel like it masters me anymore. I feel like it can crop its face up in my head and heart at times, and I call it out. But, you know, fear of failure is a big one. I know people who are paralyzed by fear of success. You know, I think fear, where I'm at now with fear is that I think fear almost points the way. And what I mean by that is whatever fear is haunting you, most likely that's the direction you should go. Because fear wants you to not go somewhere. It's almost like it's standing in the doorway saying, you're not going in this room. And in reality, if you actually went towards that door and went through the fear, the common sort of point of view afterwards that people tell me is, what was I so afraid of once they get on the other side of that door? So fear points the way. And oftentimes in life planning, if it's a fear of failure of some kind or a fear of maybe I don't have what it takes, well, maybe that's what you should go pursue.
Do you see that in organizations too, when you're guiding them through StratOps? Do you see teams get wrapped up in those things?
Absolutely. I mean, culture, right, is real. Culture is as real as the air we breathe. You can't see it and describe it, but it's there. It's the vibe you feel in any environment. So you feel vibes in whether it's a company or a nonprofit environment, and fear can paralyze thinking and movement in a team. So if the culture isn't trusting and empowering and releasing people to go to literally go fail at something. Why? Because we learn when we fail. And sometimes we discover whole new innovative opportunities when we fail. And we would never have discovered that if we hadn't tried. So yes, I see fear paralyze both the strategic insights and then the execution side of actionables. Mm.
I saw a quote just yesterday from Georgia O'Keeffe where she said, you know, I've never had a day in my life without fear. I've just chosen that it's not going to prevent me from doing what I want to do. So it's kind of speaks to what you were talking about. It's exactly. Less about trying to eradicate it and more trying to say, how do I still move forward even with this nemesis kicking around at times? So that's great. Pete, we're going to shift now into our quick fire round. So again, you've done this before, but asking you a short question and getting your immediate response. What's a favorite movie of yours and why?
Well, if I go back years, the Braveheart movie was, I still think about that at times. I think the theme of freedom, I think rising to embracing the moment and the call of the moment.
I think that movie was about freedom from the Brits. We won't talk about that, but who's a historical hero of yours and why?
Abraham Lincoln. He had a lot of fear, a lot of doubt, but he did the right thing.
That's good. And lastly, a more personal question in your own case, what's a part of your own life vision that you see coming to life, coming to reality in this season?
Seeing other people on the journey to mastery and starting to taste it. And that's so rewarding to me.
It's awesome. Well, Pete, thank you so much for joining us today and leading us through this conversation around the journey of mastery. It's been great to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you.
You've been listening to the Patterson Podcast. This episode was produced and edited by Mary Wade. Special thanks to Ox Creative for the music. And if you're listening and wanting to know more, you can reach out to us at PattersonCenter.com. That's Patterson with one T. It would be our pleasure to hear from you and to guide you deeper into this conversation. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes, and when you're there, please leave us a review. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and we look forward to seeing you next time.